Today's episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. Need book reviews, genre lists, and updates on cases I've covered on the podcast? Well, what about a last-minute Father's Day gift? The Best Evidence newsletter has you covered on all those counts 5 days a week for just $5 a month. That's at bestevidence.fyi. And now, today's episode.
I was looking at these documents that was confirming that as a black woman, my life wasn't shit. It didn't mean anything. It had no purpose.
The California penal system gives new meaning to the term operating with impunity, and yet the crimes committed against inmates aren't new at all in Belly of the Beast. The only thing facial recognition software really does well is discriminate, encoded bias. And filmmaker Yasmin Neal talks with me about strange fruit and superhero imagery in her short Target Practice. I'm staycationing on the festival circuit in The Blotter Presents, episode 147. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that looks at how true crime is told and sold. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm on my own for the top of the show, surveying a couple of entries in the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. The fest runs through June 20th online, but you can follow it on Twitter year-round at HRW Film Festival, and I will have a link in the show notes. Later on, I'll be talking to Yasmin Neal about her short film, Target Practice, but first, let's get into festival reviews. First up, we're talking about Belly of the Beast. Here's the case file from the festival listing for the film. Quote, when a courageous young woman and a radical lawyer discover a pattern of illegal, involuntary sterilizations in California's women's prison system, they take to the courtroom to wage a near impossible battle against the Department of Corrections. With a growing team of investigators inside prison working with colleagues on the outside, they uncover a series of statewide crimes, from dangerously inadequate health care to sexual assault to coercive sterilizations, primarily targeting women of color. But no one believes them. This shocking legal battle, captured over 7 years, features extraordinary access and intimate accounts from currently and formerly incarcerated women, demanding our attention for a shameful and ongoing legacy of eugenics and reproductive injustice in the United States. End quote. Directed and produced by Erica Cohn, Belly of the Beast didn't make me start weeping, the kind of weeping that seems to come up from the groundswell of the self, until minute 55. So there's that. Cohn, who also directed Peabody-nominated The Judge, is a competent director. There is some Newsmaggy B-roll here, like of a jailhouse door clanging shut with figurative import, and a couple of drone shots, but for the most part, Cohn wisely stays out of the way of her subject, which is sufficiently and comprehensively shocking on its own. Cohn also wisely hews as closely as she can to the single outrage she's tasked herself with, resisting opportunities to turn down related topic roads like endemic rape and sexual extortion of woman-identified prisoners, or the multiply bigoted concept of the good victim in cases of domestic violence. Well, actually, Belly of the Beast does get into that. It has no choice, as one of its primary subjects, Kelly Dillon, got a 15-year sentence for killing her abuser. Why? Clip one.
Most of people see victims as very fragile, docile, helpless, white. We are seen as aggressive.
When a police officer approaches a female African-American or Latina, they automatically ask them, are you gang affiliated? 92% of all the women that are in prison because of domestic violence.
I have already been sexually assaulted. I had already been held hostage in the house for 3 days. When I called the police, they said, you don't look like a victim. So I had lost hope in the people that was supposed to be there to protect and serve me.
Right.
At that point, I had it. Either I was going to get out by foot or in a body bag. I just wanted out.
As I said, what Cohn does cover is horrific enough, including one of the doctors responsible for steering clearly eugenics-based procedures in the California correctional system, one James Heinrich, who frequently conducted gynecological exams while eating a sandwich and made little secret of thinking that certain, quote, repeat offenders should be sterilized for the good of their unborn children and California's bottom line. There's also a cameo appearance by the failure of healthcare workers to believe women of color's accounts of their own pain and symptoms, and fatism substituted for ethical charting in clip two.
I felt like I was losing a lot of weight at the time. I was in a lot of pain. I thought that I was dying.
What did you weigh when you went into prison?
Like 235 pounds.
What was the least that you weighed?
118 pounds. The doctor thought maybe I was a hypochondriac. And he said that that I should be happy that I had lost weight. So many women would love to have lost the amount of weight that I've lost. One doctor told me, well, how do you expect for someone to treat you if you are suing them?
Oh, did I mention the stereotyping people of color as lazy fakers? No? Well, there's that too. Fortunately, Kelly and her sister in this fight have teenage punk turned activist Cynthia Chandler on their side. Chandler was radicalized on the subject of privilege early in her life.
You couldn't hang out with kids in the 1980s in the emergence of the HIV epidemic and not understand the horrors of policing, the horrors of what happens when people don't have access to health care, the horrors of racism, all of this stuff all intertwined. I could be with those kids in the same street corner, and my life was going to turn out differently because of my class privilege and racial privilege. And so I felt like it behooved me to do something to change that.
But Chandler is fighting a system that, as some are only recently learning, is stacked against women of color. And I am being reminded by Belly of the Beast that the shameful tradition of eugenics in the United States was considered an educational model by the actual Nazis.
After World War II, eugenics goes sort of underground.
The distribution of people is far off balance. High birth rates go hand in hand with low incomes.
It became more a policy of population control through birth control policy, welfare policy, and now it was targeted mostly at women of color.
Got enough children, what do we do? Got enough children, what do we do?
There are government-sponsored campaigns to sterilize indigenous women, women on Puerto Rico, Mexican origin women in California, as well as black women in the United States.
You're saying sterilize the woman if she's had more than two illegitimate children.
Right.
If she's on welfare.
Absolutely.
Last week, a black Alabama couple filed a $1 million damage suit against the government, charging that their two daughters had been sterilized without their informed consent.
The song. I can't. I can't. Immediately prior to that sequence, my notes read, in all caps, holy fuck. Immediately after that, they stopped being notes at all and started being felt tip stab wounds into the notebook paper. Everyone involved knows full well that sterilizing prisoners without their consent is wrong. That's why it's buried in so many layers of paperwork, HIPAA statutes, FOIA misfilings. It's why medical staff rushed prisoners through consent paperwork or waited until pre-op sedatives had taken hold to start browbeating prisoners into agreeing to tubal ligations. But at the same time, they think it's the right thing to do because it saves money and controls a, quote, undesirable population. And when reporter Corey Johnson published his expose on the practice, he had to stop reading the comments, never a bad idea, because of just how many responses ran along the lines of what's the problem or something about chlorinating the gene pool. It wasn't that that backed up the Rage Tears septic system for me. It was more the accretion of all of it. Belly of the Beast is only 80 minutes long, but if you're looking for a mercilessly effective illustration of the principle that the, quote, system isn't broken, but is in fact functioning exactly the way it was designed to in order to oppress women and people of color, quote, great news. It looks like this one is coming to Independent Lens. Belly of the Beast is difficult and maddening, and I highly recommend it. Next up is Coded Bias, a film from Shalini Kantaya, who also directed 2015's Catching the Sun, which was about the global clean energy race. Coded Bias was nominated for the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance earlier this year. I have no doubt it will be coming to PBS in some format. Here's the case file for that one, once again from the Human Rights Watch Film Fest's circular, quote, when MIT Media Lab researcher Joy Balamwini discovers that most facial recognition software misidentifies women and darker-skinned faces, as a woman of color working in a field dominated by white males, she is compelled to investigate further. What she discovers drives her to push the U.S. government to create legislation to counter the far-reaching dangers of bias in a technology that is steadily encroaching on our lives. Centering the voices of women leading the charge to ensure our civil rights are protected, Coded Bias asks two key questions. What is the impact of artificial intelligence's increasing role in governing our liberties? And what are the consequences for people stuck in the crosshairs due to their race, color, and gender? End quote. Coded Bias's first hour is bracing and smart about how it takes us from an individual's discovery and exploration of the issues out into the wider societal implications. We learn about the early days of AI at Dartmouth in the 1950s, the way machine learning's processes took on the homogeneities of its creators, and how to explain what an algorithm is and how it can be abused in simple terms. I've been online since God was a dial-up child, and I've more or less accustomed myself to the notion that I'm eminently trackable and tracked. I've made all the jokes about the algorithm listening to my conversations with my esteemed work wife Tara, and recommending Etsy stores based on shit we said to each other literally in the middle of an open shopping plaza with a plane going overhead. But they aren't really jokes, and any trust we might have in AI isn't just misplaced. On top of being biased, much facial recognition software just doesn't work properly a lot of the time. But also, that trust, whether or not we realize it, may be derived in large part from Hollywood sci-fi ideas of AI's efficacy and value-neutral origins.
The 9000 series is the most reliable computer ever made. No 9000 computer has ever made a mistake or distorted information.
A lot of our ideas about AI come from science fiction.
Welcome to Altair 4, gentlemen.
It's everything in Hollywood. It's the Terminator.
Hasta la vista, baby.
It's Commander Data from Star Trek.
I just love scanning for life forms.
It's C-3PO from Star Wars.
It feels at approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
It is the robots that take over the world and start to think like human beings. And it's all totally imaginary. What we actually have is we have narrow AI. And narrow AI is just math.
If Coded Bias mentions Black Mirror in so many words, I didn't note it, but it's hard not to think about it. When you're watching a Chinese national talk about the, quote, social credit score that country uses on its citizens while she's accessing a Pepsi machine using a facial scanner. But as one Talking Head interviewee notes, at least the Chinese government is transparent about it. Here in the States, Big Brother is corporations, and they want us to behave by buying stuff.
Building systems that automatically tag and categorize all of the people within China is a good way of maintaining social order. Conversely, in the United States, we have not seen a detailed point of view on artificial intelligence. So what we see is that AI is not being developed for what's best in our public interest, but rather it's being developed for commercial applications to earn revenue. I would prefer to see our Western democratic ideals baked in to our AI systems of the future. But it doesn't seem like that's what's probably going to be happening.
What a gentle, gentle understatement from a commentator, I believe is Amy Webb, whose on-screen title chyron is Futurist. And while that is kind of annoying, I'd still like to read her book. Coded bias is particularly relevant to what's on all of our minds of late, racial injustice in law enforcement, and the ways AI can widen the fairness gap, not only by getting things wrong, but by perpetrating the biases built into it in every corner of the system. AI is used to assess risk levels of parolees and recommend sentencing guidelines to judges, for starters. I also can't say I'm particularly surprised that AI is being used on the mostly of color residents of an apartment building in Brownsville, Brooklyn, to harass them about dumb shit like leaving a doormat outside their apartments. Clip 7 is long, but instructive.
Atlantic Plaza Towers in Brownsville is at the center of a security struggle. The landlord filed an application last year to replace the key fob entry with a biometric security system, commonly known as facial recognition.
We thought that they wanted to take the key fobs out and install the facial recognition software. I didn't find out until way later on, literally, that they wanted to keep it all. Pretty much turn this place into Fort Knox, a jail, Rikers Island.
There's this old saw in science fiction, which is the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. And what they tend to mean when they say that is that rich people get the fancy tools first and then it goes last to the poor. But in fact, what I've found is the absolute reverse, which is the most punitive, most invasive, most surveillance-focused tools that we have, they go into poor and working communities first. And then if they work, after being tested in this environment where there's sort of low expectation that people's rights will be respected, then they get ported out to other communities.
Why did Mr. Nelson pick on his building in Brownsville that is predominantly in a black and brown area? Why didn't you go to your building in Lower Manhattan where they pay like $5,000 a month rent? What did the Nazis do? They wrote on people's arms, okay, so that they could track them. What do we do to our animals? We put chips in them so you can track them. I feel that I, as a human being, should not be tracked, okay? I'm not a robot, okay? I am not an animal, so why treat me like an animal? And I have rights.
I can't say I'm unable to trace the future of this technology forward from here to an entirely profit-based version that uses pre-existing racial and class biases to leverage misdemeanor behavior into a debt-slash-probation cycle that only profits the software's inventors. This is the kind of revolving door tying justice to personal wealth that Khalif Browder and so many others have gotten stuck in. Coded bias was obviously finalized some time ago and doesn't include Amazon's quite recent and quite spinelessly temporary, in my opinion, pivot away from licensing its recognition software to law enforcement agencies. You can actually find Adweek's piece on that development in the show notes and in last Friday's edition of the Best Evidence Newsletter. So the film couldn't use that in the third act Reasons to Hope sequence so many The Future Is Now and It Hates Us documentaries opt for. As it is, Coded Bias doesn't exactly trail off, but the last half hour is a bit static and repetitive compared to the first two-thirds. Still, if you were looking for the motivation you needed to fire up Tweet Delete and start kicking gravel across your digital footprints, Coded Bias will absolutely provide it. I recommend this one too, not least for its determined, but not performative, centering of the voices most affected by the rise of these machines. Finally, in today's episode, I am pleased to run my interview with filmmaker Yasmin Neal. Neal's short, Target Practice, is linked in the show notes. Go find that and give it a watch before you continue with the podcast. It's only 6 minutes long, and seeing it will make the interview more enjoyable. I'll wait. Oh, hey, so I heard about Target Practice via a press email. Here's the logline from that email, which followed glowing blurbs from Viola Davis and Law & Order's own Jill Hennessy. Quote, Target Practice follows Calvin, a young African-American boy who has an issue that he can't seem to get rid of, so he embarks on a journey for help. As he wanders through a big, intimidating world searching for someone to come to his aid, he stumbles upon a doctor's office and enters. He is greeted by a female assistant, but he shies away from her until he receives the attention of the male doctor in the room that looks like him. When the doctor approaches, Calvin speaks for the first time, asking, "Can you help me take this off?" He then lifts his shirt to unveil an ugly truth that the doctor knows will plague the young boy for a lifetime. Yasmin Neal isn't just an award-winning writer-director. She was also, quote, the youngest member of the Georgia House of Representatives from 2011 to 2013, elected at the age of 25 years old. She has a bachelor's degree in criminal justice and an MBA in global management, and has served as a police officer on the chief's staff at the Clayton County Police Department, and was a detective in the major felony unit. Yasmin also worked at the Clayton County Sheriff's Department as an internal affairs slash backgrounds and hiring investigator, and then an investigator in the fugitive unit. So, not intimidating at all. Actually, Neal was lovely to talk to and tolerated my dumb process questions very kindly. So here is our conversation.
So target practice is a short. It is a true short, 6 odd minutes. I feel that short anything is really an underrated way of telling stories across media. Was this story always a short in your mind?
Yes, target practice was always a short from the beginning.
The rendition of Strange Fruit guides the narrative so completely. Did the story come out of the song? Or did the story come first and take you to the song? What was the relationship there?
Yeah, so the story definitely came first, and then it took me to the song. I was going to go with just a generic track or have one of my friends create something. But being very familiar with that song and the different renditions of it, I felt that because of the content of the story, that song would be more powerful once I layered it with the image.
Right. And was it always Nina Simone's that you felt you were going to use, or did you go back and forth on different versions?
I actually preferred to use Billie Holiday's. I thought there was more pain in that one.
Mm-hmm.
On top of the fact that I think she died shortly thereafter recording that.
Right.
So that one was more heart-wrenching for me, and I preferred that version.
There's also a lot of archetypal slash American hero symbology in the film.
Yes.
The Superman backpack that Calvin has, he's on a hero quest of sorts, albeit maybe only the like Slough of Despond part. and then the target on him does have this twisted reference to Captain America. Were you thinking of the story in terms of these big American hero symbologies, or did they just kind of bubble up out of it?
No, they're definitely intentional. What I find is an unfortunate truth when it comes to, especially minority children, oftentimes, short of Black Panther, and there, I know there are a few other superheroes throughout like the comic book realm, that are minority, but I found that oftentimes the ones that most children are familiar with are the ones of Caucasian persuasion, which there's nothing wrong with that, but it makes them feel just like anyone else, like they're a superhero and they play with these toys and they watch the movies and they read the comic books. But in reality, sometimes those things that they use as their barriers, as that armor that they like a little boy is so empowered when he has his book bag or when he wears his Superman t-shirt.
Right.
But the comparison is the fact that even all those things, and even if it's a psychological thing of them feeling safe, those things cannot keep them from the harsh reality that they're kind of powerless when it comes to the brutalities that they face in the real world.
Sure.
So it's definitely intentional to have both of those coverings in the front and the back for different reasons. And the
right.
backpack was definitely very intentional for me.
Right. So speaking of the harsh realities, the actor playing Calvin, Jaleel Muhammad, I don't know how old he is, but he's, you know, this is a kid. How is it directing a child in this story?
Very interesting you asked that. So at the time, I think he was 8. I think he's 9 now.
Mm-hmm.
But this is my first time working with him. He's actually been on a TV show in the past called Shots Fired. He was actually reoccurring. I think he did that when he was 6, 5
okay.
or 6. So he's a brilliant actor already. He's actually better than some adults I've met. but ironically enough, before shooting, I had to have a moment with myself like, hey, you're about to put a target on a child. Let's talk to his mom. So I called the mom and I was like, hey, there's some psychological impact here when it comes to what we're about to do. So I definitely wanted to have this conversation with you. And I asked her, has she told him about what's been going on in America? And she said, no, she keeps that information away from him. She doesn't let him watch the news, so he really doesn't know what's going on.
Right.
And so my question to her was, okay, because of what we're doing, do we need to introduce it to him so he knows what's going on? Or do you want to keep him sheltered for as long as possible? And she preferred to keep him sheltered for as long as possible. So I say that to say, when it comes to directing children, it's very different from adults, because oftentimes they do not have a point of reference for their emotions.
Right. So
when you're dealing with adults and you say, hey, think of a time you were in love, or think of a time when you, you know, lost your car. How are you feeling then? You know, you try to sometimes when you deal with actors and actresses, sometimes you try to give them a point of reference or a life reference to take themselves to. But for children, they don't have that. So I did a lot of research beforehand, because he worked with me on a horror short that I did, because we had to help him find what terror looks like and what terror feels like. He'd never experienced that before.
Okay.
So coming into this, when tapping into what he was going to tap into to find that level of fear or that level of being unsure, that part was relatively easy. Because he's just a really good actor. So I didn't have to tell him what to do when it came to looking confused or feeling a certain way. Because those are basic emotions that he could find.
Right.
That I can reference in his childlike form. Like, hey, how do you feel if you lost you didn't get a chance to get a snack in school? So he just refer to those moments. But what was interesting is, to this day, he still has no clue about what the film is about. He just really enjoyed being able to be painted on.
Uh-huh.
So even when it's been nominated for a selection at numerous festivals, and it was a finalist at the Morehouse Human Rights Festival for the Spike Lee Award. And even when he's questioned or what have you, he still has no idea what the film was about.
He still has no idea. Wow, that's a hell of a thing. I mean, and yeah. That sort of gives that gives even more layers to that performance and to that final scene. So by comparison, how was it directing the grown-ups in that final scene, knowing that they had to sort of, he had to be, the kid had to be shielded from the real reference?
Yes. Well, that part was a separate conversation, of course, but the response, because he didn't know what that meant, he didn't really understand why they were either crying or why they were acting that way. He just felt, it's very interesting dealing with that particular young man, because he understands it's a job.
Right.
And so regardless of what's going on around him, he knows that he has to stay in character, and he knows that everybody else is doing their job too.
Right.
So he's able to still give his performance and let everybody else do their jobs and not be affected by, like, hey, why are they crying? Like, he is completely unaffected by any of that. It's actually interesting. He's actually brilliant to watch when he's on set. But yeah, so the conversation with the adult actors was separate. And the gentleman himself, Travis Kure, he actually plays on Tyler Perry's TV show, The Oval, that's on now.
Right.
And I worked with him numerous times before, so he knew exactly what we were going for. And I had those two kind of develop a little rapport beforehand, and they just nailed it. But yeah, the conversation about how they responded was separate from Jaleel's performance.
Sure. Well, that is fascinating that the whole film comes down to, like, scales falling from this character's eyes, but then the actor is not having that experience. Wow, that's amazing. Yeah. So you mentioned that this was a festival selection in 2019, right? That's what I saw?
Yes.
So 2020 has changed the scenery from everyone's window, so to say.
Yes.
Are you, as you're sort of revisiting this and talking to people about it in 2020, are you seeing anything in it that you didn't before? Are people seeing things in it that you weren't aware were there? Like, has anything changed about, I don't know, where it's sitting for you this year versus last year?
Well, last year, I don't know. I think it's one of those things. I mean, minorities were getting killed last year as well, but it's something about this year that made this film really stick out to people. Because this was going on before now. I guess the only thing I didn't anticipate is I knew it would touch people. I didn't realize how deeply it would touch people, like the messages and the posts that I'm getting from people, thousands and thousands of people from across the world. I think we're over a million views at this point. It's just been amazing. And they're telling me their stories, they're giving me their background. And it's really, really affecting people to at a point where I did not know. I didn't know it was going to be that deep to so many people. And I haven't seen not one negative comment about it, but I am very floored at the response. The one thing I did see, which is something I considered, is they were like, hey, it would be kind of cool if the older man would have lifted up his shirt and we would have saw a target on him as well.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't think of that.
Yeah, I thought about that, but I wanted to keep it from the perspective of the child.
Right, right. Well, I mean, it worked. You were right. So what's next for you, film-wise? Anything coming up?
Yeah, so I have a number of pieces that I'm filming. Ironically, yes, they do mix the social justice piece with the fun narrative side of things. It's funny, I didn't realize that was the direction I was taking as I continued to write over the years. And even when it comes to now and seeing where my writing has taken me, it's timely. That's the number one thing. But yes, I do have a number of pieces that I'm beginning to work on as far as actually filming them and putting them out to the world that are coming.
That's all I've got. Thank you so much for doing this. This has really been great.
Yeah, thank you so much. I think Viola Davis really helped push this thing over the top.
She's a national treasure.
Yes. So I was deeply humbled and honored when she posted the film and got it, I think, the attention that it deserved.
I agree. And congratulations on it. It really knocked me out.
Yay. Thank you so much.
Well, that's it for this episode of The Blotter Presents. Coming up, I had intended to review Down a Dark Stairwell from the Human Rights Watch Film Festival today. A screener snafu prevented that from happening, but I am very interested in the film and I will bring a review of it to you as a blotter brief later in the month. Coming up on the main podcast next week, it's Jeb Lund on the true story behind Proof of Life in a documentary called Miracle Fishing. And after that, Mike Dunn is joining me to discuss I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and the Gram, and in the Best Evidence newsletter, bestevidence.fyi. For more information on the films I discussed today, dig those show notes. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.